thieves escaping.
They ran, or rather Tom ran, and dragged Hester along beside him, hearing her whimper in pain at every step. Up a stairway, along a catwalk, past a shrine to Peripatetia, goddess of wandering towns, and they were in a market square, lined with big iron cages, in some of which thin, miserable slaves were waiting to be sold off. Tom forced himself to slow down and tried to look inconspicuous, listening all the time for sounds of pursuit. There were none. Maybe the Raylands had given up the chase, or maybe they weren't allowed to chase people onto other towns. Tom didn't know what the rules were in a trading cluster.
"Head for the bows,"
said Hester, letting go his arm and pulling the collar of her coat up to hide her face.
"If we're lucky, there'll be an air harbor at the bows."
They were lucky. At the front of the town's top deck was a raised section where half a dozen small airships were tethered, their dark, gas-filled envelopes like sleeping whales.
"Are we going to steal one?" Tom whispered.
"Not unless you know how to fly an airship," said Hester weakly.
"There's an airman's cafe over there. We'll have to try and book passage like normal people."
The cafe was just an ancient rusting airship gondola that had been bolted to the deck. A few metal tables stood in front, beneath a stripy awning. Hurricane lamps were burning there, and an old aviator slumped snoring in a chair. The only other customer was a sinister-looking woman in a long red leather coat who sat in the shadows near the bar. In spite of the dark, she wore sunglasses, the tiny lenses black as the wing cases of beetles. She turned to stare at Tom as he walked up to the counter. A small man with a huge, drooping moustache was polishing glasses. He glanced up without much interest when Tom said,
"I'm looking for a ship."
"Where to?"
"London," said Tom. "Me and my friend have to get back to London, and we have to leave tonight."
"London, is it?"
The man's mustachios twitched like the tails of two squirrels that had been shoved up his nose and were starting to get a bit restless.
"Only ships with a license from the London Merchants Guild can dock there. We've got nothing like that here. Staines ain't that sort of town."
"Perhaps I may be of help,"
suggested a soft, foreign-sounding voice at Tom's shoulder. The woman in the red coat had come silently to his side. A lean, handsome woman with badgery slashes of white in her short black hair. Reflections of the hurricane lamps danced in her sunglasses, and when she smiled, Tom noticed that her teeth were stained red.
"I haven't a license for London, but I am going to Airhaven. You could find a ship there that will take you the rest of the way. Have you some money?"
Tom hadn't thought about that part. He rummaged in his tunic and fished out two tattered banknotes with the face of Quirk on the front and Magnus Crone gazing sternly from the back. He had put them in his pocket the night he fell out of London, hoping to spend them at the catch party in Kensington Gardens. Here, under the fizzing hurricane lamps of the air harbour, they looked out of place, like toy money. The woman seemed to think so too.
"Aha," she said. 20 quirks. But notes like that can only be spent in London. Not much use to a poor, wandering skyfarer like me. Don't you have any gold, or old tech?"
Tom shrugged and mumbled something. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw some newcomers pushing their way between the tables.
"Look, Uncle Wayland,"
he heard one of them shout.
"Here they are. We've got 'em."
Tom looked around and saw Rayland and a couple of his boys closing in, carrying heavy clubs. He grabbed Hester, who was leaning against the counter, barely conscious. One of the Speedwell men moved to cut off their escape, but the woman in the red coat barred his way, and Tom heard her say,
"These are my passengers. I was just arranging a fee."
"They're our slaves,"
shouted Rayland, pushing past her.
"Tom Knitsworthy and his friend found 'em in the out country, fair and square. Finders keepers."
Tom hurried Hester across the metal deck, past stairways leading up to the quays where the airships moored. He could hear Raylan's men splitting up, shouting to each other as they searched. Then a grunt and a crash, as if one of them had fallen over. Good, he thought, but he knew that the others would soon find him. He dragged Hester up a short iron stairway to the quays. There were lights in some of the ships that hung at anchor there, and he had a vague idea about forcing his way aboard one of them and making them take him to London. But he had nothing that would serve as a weapon, and before he could look for one, there were feet ringing on the ladder behind him, and Raylan's voice saying,
"Please try and be reasonable, Mr. Nitsworthy. I don't want to have to hurt you. Fred," he added, "I've got the rotters cornered. Fred?"
Tom felt the hope drain out of him. There was no escape now. He stood there meekly as Raylan stepped forward into the light from the portholes of a nearby airship, hefting his club. Hester slumped against a dockside winch and moaned.
"It's only fair," said Raylan,
as if he thought she was complaining.
"I don't like this slaving lark any more than you do, but times are hard, and we did catch you, there's no denying it."
Suddenly, faster than Tom would have thought possible, Hester moved. She dragged a metal lever out of the winch and swung it at Raylan. His club went whirling out of his hand and hit the deck with a glockenspiel sound, and the metal bar struck him a glancing blow on the side of his head.
"Ow!"
he wailed, crumpling to the floor. Hester lurched forward and raised the bar again, but before she could bring it down on the old man's skull, Tom grabbed her arm.
"Stop! You'll kill him!"
"So?" She swung toward him, snaggle teeth bared, looking like a demented monkey.
"So?"
"He's right, my dear," said a gentle voice. "There is no need to finish him."
Out of the shadows stepped the woman from the bar, her red coat swirling around her ankles as she walked toward them.
"I think we should get aboard my ship before the rest of his people come looking for you."
"You said we didn't have enough money,"
Tom reminded her.
"You don't, Mr. Nitsworthy," said the aviatrix. "But I can hardly stand by and watch you be taken away to be sold as slaves, can I? I was a slave myself once, and I wouldn't recommend it."
She had taken off her glasses. Her eyes were dark and almond-shaped, and fine webs of laughter lines crinkled at their corners when she smiled.
"Besides," she added, "you intrigue me. Why is a Londoner wandering about in the hunting ground getting into trouble?"
She held out her hand to Tom, a long, brown hand with the thin machinery of bones and tendons clearly visible, sliding under papery skin.
"How do we know you won't betray us, like Raylan did?" he demanded.
"You don't, of course," she laughed. "You will just have to trust me."
After Valentine and the Raylans, Tom didn't think he would ever be able to trust anybody again, but this strange foreigner was the only hope he had.
"All right," he said, "but Raylan got my name wrong. It's Natsworthy."
"And mine is Fang," said the woman. "Miss Anna Fang."
She still had her hand outstretched, as if he were a scared animal she wanted to tame, and she was still smiling her alarming red smile.
"My ship is on Air Key 6.
So they went with her, and somewhere in the oily shadows under the quays, they stepped over Raylan's companions, who lay slumped against a stanchion, with their heads lolling drunkenly.
"Are they?"
whispered Tom.
"Out cold," said Miss Fang. "I'm afraid I just don't know my own strength."
Tom wanted to stop and check that the men were all right, but she led him quickly past and up a ladder to Key 6. The ship that hung at anchor there was not the elegant sky clipper Tom had been expecting. In fact, it was little more than a shabby scarlet gas bag, and a cluster of rusty engine pods bolted to a wooden gondola.
"It's made of junk," he gasped.
"Junk?" laughed Miss Fang. "Why, the Jenny Hanover is built from bits of the finest airships that ever flew. An envelope of silicon silk from a Shanguo clipper. Twin Jeunet Caro aero engines off a Paris gunship. The reinforced gas cells of a Spitzbergen war balloon. It's amazing what you can find in the scrapyards."
She led them up the gangplank into the cramped, spicy-smelling gondola. It was just a narrow wooden tube with a flight deck at the front and Miss Fang's quarters at the stern, a jumble of other little cabins in between. Tom had to keep ducking to avoid braining himself on overhead lockers and dangerous-looking bundles of cables that hung from instrument panels on the roof. But the aviatrix flitted around, mumbling in some strange foreign tongue as she set switches, pulled levers, and lit dim green electrics that filled the cabin with an aquarium glow. She laughed when she saw Tom's worried look.
"That is Esperanto, the common language of the sky. It's a lonely life on the bird roads, and I have a habit of talking to myself."
She pulled on a final lever, and the creak and sigh of gas valves echoed through the gondola. There was a clang as the magnetic docking clamps released, and the radio crackled into life and snapped,
"Jenny Hanover, this is the Staines Harbour Board. You are not cleared for departure."
But the Jenny Hanover was departing anyway. Tom felt his stomach turn over as she lifted into the midnight sky. He scrambled to a porthole and saw the market town falling away below. Then Speedwell came into view, and soon the whole cluster was spread out below him like a display of model towns in the museum.
"Jenny Hanover," insisted the loudspeaker, "return to your berth at once. We have a request from the Speedwell Town Council that you give up your passengers or they will be forced to..."
"Boring,"
trilled Miss Fang, flicking the radio off. A homemade rocket battery on the roof of Speedwell Town Hall spat a fizzing flock of missiles after them. Three hissed harmlessly past, a fourth exploded off the starboard quarter, making the gondola swing like a pendulum, and the fifth came even closer. Anna Fang raised an eyebrow at that one, while Tom and Hester ducked for cover like frightened rabbits. Then they were out of range. The Jenny Hanover was climbing into the cold, clear spaces of the night, and the trading cluster was just a distant smear of light beneath the clouds. Chapter 10. The 13th Floor Elevator. It rained that night on London, but by first light the sky was as clear and pale as still water, and the smoke from the city's engines rose straight up into the windless air. Wet decks shone silver in the sunrise, and all the banners of Tier 1 hung limp and still against their flagpoles. It was a fine spring morning, the morning that Valentine had been hoping for and Catherine had been dreading. It was perfect flying weather. Although it was so early, crowds had gathered all along the edge of Tier 1 to watch the 13th floor elevator lift off. As Gensch drove Catherine and her father over to the air key, she saw that Circle Park was crowded too. It looked as if the whole of High London had come to cheer Valentine on his way. None of them knew where he was going, of course, but as London sped eastward, the city's rumour mills had been grinding night and day. Everyone was sure that Valentine's expedition was connected with some huge prize that the Lord Mayor hoped to catch out in the central hunting ground. Temporary stands had been erected for the council and guilds, and when she and Dog had wished Father goodbye in the bustling shadows of the hangar, Catherine went to take her place with the historians, squeezed between Chudley Pomeroy and Dr. Arkengarth. All around her stood the great and good of London, the sober black robes of Father's Guild and the purple of the Guild of Merchants, somber navigators in their neat green tunics, and a row of engineers robed and hooded in white rubber, looking like novelty erasers. Even Magnus Crome had risen to the occasion, and the Lord Mayor's ancient chain of office hung gleaming around his thin neck. Catherine wished they had all just stayed at home. It was difficult saying goodbye to someone when you were part of a great cheering mob all waving flags and blowing kisses. She stroked Dog's knobbly head and told him,
"Look, there's Father, going up the gangplank now. They'll start the engines in a moment."
"I just hope nothing goes wrong," muttered Dr. Arkengarth. "One hears stories about these airships suddenly going off, bang, for no reason."
"Perhaps we should stand a little farther back," suggested Miss Plym, the museum's twittery curator of furniture.
"Nonsense," Catherine told them crossly. "Nothing is going to go wrong."
Yes, do shut up, Arkengarth, you silly old coot," agreed Chudley Pomeroy, surprising her. "Never fear, Miss Valentine. Your father has the finest airship and the best pilots in the world. Nothing can go wrong."
Catherine smiled gratefully at him, but she kept her fingers crossed just the same, and Dog caught something of her mood and started to whimper softly. From inside the hangar came the sound of hatches slamming shut and the rattle of boarding ladders being dragged clear. An expectant hush fell over the stands. Along the tier's edge, High London held its breath. Then, as the band struck up Rule Londinium, Valentine's ground crew began dragging the 13th floor elevator out into the sunlight. A sleek, black dart whose armoured envelope shone like silk. On the open platform at the stern of the control gondola, Valentine stood waving. He saluted the ground crew and the flag-decked stands, and then smiled straight at Catherine, picking her face out of all the others without a moment's hesitation. She waved back frantically, and the crowd cheered themselves hoarse as the 13th floor elevator's engine pods swiveled into takeoff position. The ground crew cast off the mooring hawsers, the propellers began to turn, and blizzards of confetti eddied in the downdrafts as the huge machine lifted into the air. Some apprentice historians spread out a banner reading "Happy Valentine's Day," and the cheers went on and on, as if the crowds thought it was their love alone that was keeping the explorer airborne.
"Valentine! Valentine!"
But Valentine took no notice of the noise or the flags. He stood watching Catherine, one hand raised in farewell, until the airship was so high and far away that she could not make him out any more. At last, when the elevator was just a speck in the eastern sky and the stands were emptying, she wiped away her tears, took Dog's lead, and turned to go home. She was already missing her father, but she had a plan now. While he was away, she would make her own inquiries and find out who that mysterious girl had been and why she scared him so. Chapter 11. Air Haven. Once he had washed and slept and had something to eat, Tom began to decide that adventuring might not be so bad after all. By sunrise, he was already starting to forget the misery of his trek across the mud and imprisonment in Speedwell. The view from the Jenny Hanover's big forward windows as the airship flew between golden mountains of dawn-lit cloud was enough to make even the pain of Valentine's betrayal fade a little. At breakfast time, drinking hot chocolate with Miss Fang on the flight deck, he found that he was enjoying himself. As soon as the Jenny Hanover was safely out of the range of Speedwell's rockets, the aviatrix had become all smiles and kindness. She locked her airship on course and set about finding Tom a warm fleece-lined coat and making up a bed for him in the hold, a space high up inside the airship's envelope, heaped with a cargo of sealskins from Spitzbergen. Then she led Hester into the medical bay and went to work on her injured leg. When Tom looked in on her after breakfast that morning, the girl was sleeping soundly under a white blanket.
"I gave her something for the pain," explained Miss Fang. "She will sleep for hours, but you need have no fear for her."
Tom stared at Hester's sleeping face. Somehow he had expected her to look better now that she had been washed and fed and had her leg fixed. But of course she was as hideous as ever.
"He has made a mess of her, your wicked Mr. Valentine," the aviatrix said,
leading him back to the flight deck, where she took the controls off their automatic setting.
"How do you know about Valentine?" asked Tom.
"Oh, everyone has heard about Thaddeus Valentine," she laughed. "I know that he is London's greatest historian, and I also know that that is just a cover for his real work as Chrome's secret agent."
"That's not true,"
Tom started to say, still instinctively defending his ex-hero. But there had always been rumours that Valentine's expeditions involved something darker than mere archaeology, and now that he had seen the great man's ruthless handiwork, he believed them. He blushed, ashamed for Valentine, and ashamed of himself for having loved him. Miss Fang watched him with a faint, sympathetic smile.
"Hester told me a great deal more last night while I was tending to her wound," she said gently. "You are both very lucky to be alive."
"I know," agreed Tom,
but he could not help feeling uneasy that Hester had shared their story with this stranger. He sat down in the co-pilot's seat and studied the controls, a baffling array of knobs and switches and levers labelled in mixtures of Esperanto, English, and Chinese. Above them, a little lacquered shrine had been fixed to the bulkhead, decorated with red ribbons and pictures of Miss Fang's ancestors. That smiling Manchu air merchant must be her father, he supposed. And had that red-haired lady from the ice wastes been her mum?
"So, tell me, Tom," asked Miss Fang, setting the ship on a new course, "where is London going?"
The question was unexpected.
"I don't know," Tom said.
"Oh, surely you must know something," she laughed. "Your city has left its hidey hole in the west, come back across the land bridge, and now it is whizzing off into the central hunting ground, like a bat out of Hull, as the saying goes. You must have heard at least a rumour, no?"
Her long eyes slid toward Tom, who licked his lips nervously, wondering what to say. He had never paid any attention to the stupid tales the other apprentices swapped about where London was heading. He really had no idea. And even if he had, he knew it would be wrong to go revealing his city's plans to mysterious foreign aviatrices. What if Miss Fang flew off and told some larger city where to lie in wait for London in exchange for a finder's fee? And yet, if he didn't tell her something, she might kick him off her airship, perhaps without even bothering to land it first.
"Pray," he blurted out. "The Guild of Navigators say there are lots and lots of prey in the central hunting ground."
The red smile grew even broader.
"Really?"
"I heard it from the head navigator himself," said Tom, growing bolder.
Miss Fang nodded, beaming. Then she hauled on a long brass lever. Gas valves grumbled up inside the envelope, and Tom's ears popped as the Jenny Hanover started to descend, plunging into a thick white layer of cloud.
"Let me show you the central hunting ground," she chuckled,
checking the charts that were fastened to the bulkhead beside her shrine. Down and down, and then the cloud thinned and parted, and Tom saw the vast outcountry spread below him like a crumpled sheet of grey-brown paper, slashed with long blue shapes that were the flooded track marks of countless towns. For the first time since the airship lifted away from Staines, he felt afraid. But Miss Fang murmured,
"Nothing to fear, Tom."
He calmed himself and gazed out at the amazing view. Far to the north he could see the cold glitter of the ice wastes and the dark cones of the Tannhäuser fire mountains. He looked for London and eventually thought he saw it, a tiny grey speck that raised a cloud of dust behind it as it trundled along, much farther off than he had hoped. There were other towns and cities, too, dotted here and there across the plain, or lurking in the shadows of half-eaten mountain ranges, but not nearly as many as he had expected. To the southeast there were none at all, just a dingy layer of mist above a tract of marshland, and beyond that the silvery shimmer of water.
"That is the great inland sea of Kazakh," said the aviatrix when he pointed to it. "I'm sure you've heard the old land shanty."
And in a lilting, high-pitched voice she sang,
"Beware, beware of the sea of Kazakh, for the town that goes near it will never come back."
But Tom wasn't listening. He had noticed something much more terrible than any inland sea. Directly below, with the tiny shadow of the Jenny Hanover flickering across its skeletal girders, lay a dead city. It stood on ground scarred by the tracks of hundreds of smaller towns, tilting over at a strange angle, and as the Jenny Hanover swept down for a closer look, Tom realized that its tracks and gut were gone, and that its deck plates were being stripped out by a swarm of small towns that seethed in the shadows of its lower levels, tearing off huge rusting sections in their jaws and landing salvage parties whose blowtorches glittered and sparked in the shadows between the tiers like fairy lights on a Quirkmas tree. There was a puff of smoke from one of the towns, and a rocket came winding up toward the airship and exploded a few hundred feet below. Miss Fang's hands moved swiftly over the controls, and Tom felt the ship lift again.
"Half the scavengers of the hunting ground are working on the wreck of Motoropolis," she said. "And they are a jealous lot. Shoot at anybody who comes near, and when nobody does, they shoot at each other."
"But how did it get like that?" asked Tom, staring back at the huge skeleton as the Jenny Hanover carried him up and away.
"It starved," said the aviatrix. "It ran out of fuel, and as it stood motionless there, a pack of smaller towns came and started tearing it apart. The feeding frenzy has been going on for months, and I expect another city will come along soon and finish off the job. You see, Tom, there isn't enough prey to go around in the central hunting ground, so it can't be that that has brought London out of hiding."
Tom twisted around to watch as the dead city fell behind. A pack of tiny predator suburbs were harrying the scavenger towns on the northwestern side, singling out the weakest and slowest and charging after it. But before they caught it, the Jenny Hanover rose up again into the pure, clean world above the clouds, and the carcass of Motoropolis was hidden from view. When Miss Fang looked at him again, she was still smiling, but there was an odd gleam in her eyes.
"So, if it isn't prey that Magnus Chrome is after," she said, "what can it be?"
Tom shook his head.
"I'm only an apprentice historian," he confessed. "Third class. I don't really know the head navigator."
"Hester mentioned something," the aviatrix went on. "The thing Mr. Valentine took from her poor parents. Medusa. A strange name. Have you heard of it? Do you know what it means?"
Tom shook his head, and she watched him closely, watched his eyes until he felt as if she were looking right into his soul. Then she laughed.
"Well, no matter. I must get you to Airhaven, and we'll find a ship to take you home."
Airhaven. It was one of the most famous towns of the whole Traction era, and when the warble of its homing beacon came over the radio that evening, Tom went racing forward to the flight deck. He met Hester in the companionway outside the sick bay, tousled and sleepy and limping. Anna Fang had done her best with a wounded leg, but she hadn't improved the girl's manners. She hid her face when she saw Tom, and only glared and grunted when he asked her how she felt. On the flight deck, the aviatrix turned to greet them with a radiant smile.
"Look, my dears," she said, pointing ahead through the big windows. "Air Haven."
They went and stood behind her seat and looked, and far away across the sea of clouds they saw the westering sun glint on a single tier of lightweight alloy and a nimbus of brightly coloured gas bags. Long ago, the town of Air Haven had decided to escape the hungry cities by taking to the sky. It was a trading post and meeting place for aviators now, drifting above the hunting ground all summer, then flying south to winter in warmer skies. Tom remembered how it had once anchored over London for a whole week, how the sightseeing balloons had gone up and down from Kensington Gardens and Circle Park, and how jealous he had been of people like Mellifont, who were rich enough to take a trip in one and come back full of stories about the floating town. Now he was going there himself, and not just as a sightseer either. What a story he would be able to tell the other apprentices when he got home! Slowly the airship rose toward the town, and as the sun dipped behind the cloud banks in the west, Miss Fang cut her engines and let her drift in toward a docking strut, while harbour officers in sky-blue livery waved multicoloured flags to guide her safely to her berth. Behind them, the dock was crowded with sightseers and aviators, and even a little gaggle of airship spotters who dutifully jotted down the Jenny Hanover's number in their notebooks as the mooring clamps engaged. A few moments later, Tom was stepping out into the twilight and the chill, thin air, gazing at the airships coming and going, elegant high liners and rusty scows, trim little air cutters with see-through envelopes, and tiger-striped spice freighters from the Hundred Islands.
"Look," he said, pointing up at the rooftops. "There's the floating exchange. And that church is St. Michael's in the Sky. There's a picture of it in the London Museum."
But Miss Fang had seen it many, many times before, and Hester just scowled at the crowds on the quayside and hid her face. The aviatrix locked the Jenny's hatches with a key that hung on a lanyard around her neck, but when a barefoot boy ran up and tugged at her coat, saying,
"What's your airship for you, missus?"
she laughed and dropped 3 square bronze coins into his palm.
"I won't let nobody sneak aboard,"
he promised, taking up his post beside the gangplank. Uniformed dockhands appeared, grinning at Miss Fang, but staring suspiciously at her new groundling friends. They checked that the newcomers had no metal toe caps on their boots or lighted cigarettes about their persons, then led them back to the harbour office, where huge, crudely lettered notices insisted, "No smoking, turn off all electrics, and make no sparks." Sparks were the terror of the air trade, because of the danger that they might ignite the gas in the airship's envelopes. In Air Haven, even over-vigorous hairbrushing was a serious crime, and all new arrivals had to sign strict safety agreements and convince the harbour master that they were not likely to burst into flames. At last, they were allowed up a metal stairway to the High Street. Air Haven's single thoroughfare was a hoop of lightweight alloy deck plates, lined with shops and stalls, chandleries, cafes and airshipmen's hotels. Tom turned around and around, trying to take everything in and make sure he would remember it forever. He saw turbines whirling on every rooftop, and mechanics crawling like spiders over the huge engine pods. The air was thick with the exotic smells of foreign food, and everywhere he looked there were aviators, striding along with the careless confidence of people who had lived their whole lives in the sky, their long coats fluttering behind them like leathery wings. Miss Fang pointed along the curve of the High Street to a building with a sign in the shape of an airship.
"That's the Gas Bag and Gondola," she told her companions. "I'll buy you dinner, and then we'll find a friendly captain to take you back to London."
They strode toward it, the aviatrix in the lead, Hester hiding from the world behind her upraised hand, Tom still looking about in wonder and thinking it a pity that his adventures would soon be over. He didn't notice a Goshawk 90 circling among a shoal of larger vessels, waiting for a berth. Even if he had, he would not have been able to read its registration numbers at this distance, or see that the insignia on its envelope was the red wheel of the Guild of Engineers. Chapter 12. The Gasbag and Gondola. The inn was big and dark and busy. The walls were decorated with airships in bottles and the propellers of famous old sky clippers, with their names carefully painted on the blades. Nadezhna and Airy Mouse and Invisible Worm. Aviators clustered around the metal tables, talking of cargoes and the price of gas. There were Jains and Tibetans and Khoisa, Inuit and Air Tuareg, and fur-clad giants from the ice wastes. An Uyghur girl played Slipstream Serenade on her 40-string guitar, and now and then a loudspeaker would announce, "Arrival on Strut 3, the Idiot Wind, fresh from the Nuevo Mayan Palatinates, with a cargo of chocolate and vanilla." Or, "Now boarding at Strut 7, My Sharona, outbound for Archangel." Anna Fang stopped at a little shrine just inside the door and said her thanks to the gods of the sky for a safe journey. The god of aviators was a friendly-looking fellow. The fat red statue on the shrine reminded Tom of Chudley Pomeroy, but his wife, the Lady of the High Heavens, was cruel and tricky. If offended, she might brew up hurricanes or burst a gas cell. Anna made her an offering of rice cakes and lucky money, and Tom and Hester nodded their thank yous just in case. When they looked up, the aviatrix was already hurrying away from them toward a group of aviators at a corner table.
"Cora!"
she shouted, and by the time they caught up with her, she was being whirled around and around in the arms of a handsome young African and talking quickly in Esperanto. Tom was almost sure he heard her mention Medusa as she glanced back at him and Hester, but by the time they drew near, the talk had switched into English, and the African was saying, "We rode high-level winds all the way from Zagwa," and shaking red Sahara sand out of his flying helmet to prove it. He was Captain Cora of the gunship Makile Mbembe, and he came from a static enclave in the Mountains of the Moon, an ally of the Anti-Traction League. Now he was bound for Shanguo to begin a tour of duty in the League's great fortress at Batmunk Gompa. Tom was shocked at first to be sharing a table with a soldier of the League, but Cora seemed a good man, as kind and welcoming as Miss Fang herself. While she ordered food, he introduced his friends. The tall, gloomy one was Niels Lindstrom of the Garden Aeroplane Trap, and the beautiful Arab lady with the laugh was Yasmina Rashid of the Palmyrene privateer Zainab. Soon the aviators were all laughing together, reminding each other of battles above the Hundred Islands and drunken parties in the Airman's Quarter on Panzerstadt Linz. And between stories, Anna Fang pushed dishes across the table to her guests.
"More battered dormouse, Tom? Hester, try some of this delicious deviled bat."
While Tom poked the strange foreign food around his plate with a pair of wooden sticks he had been given instead of a knife and fork, Cora leaned close and said softly,
"So, are you and your girlfriend crewing aboard the Jenny now?"
"No, no," Tom assured him quickly. "I mean, no, she's not my girlfriend, and no, we are just passengers."
He fumbled with some mashed locust and asked,
"Do you know Miss Fang well?"
"Oh, yes," laughed Cora. "The whole air trade knows Anna, and the whole of the League, too, of course. In Shanguo, they call her Fung Wa, the Wind Flower."
Tom wondered why Miss Fang would have a special name in Shanguo, but before he could ask, Cora went on.
"Do you know she built the Jenny Hanover herself? When she was just a girl, she and her parents had the bad luck to be aboard a town that was eaten by Archangel. They were put to work as slaves in the airship yards there, and over the years she managed to sneak an engine here, a steering vane there, until she built herself the Jenny. and escaped.
Tom was impressed. She didn't say, he murmured, looking at the aviatrix in a new light.
She doesn't talk about it, said Cora. You see, her parents did not live to escape with her. She watched them die in the slave pits.
Tom felt a rush of sympathy for poor Miss Fang, his fellow orphan. Was that why she smiled all the time, to hide her sorrow? And was that why she had rescued Hester and himself, to save them from her parents' fate? He smiled at her as kindly as he could, and she caught his eye and smiled back and passed him a plate of crooked black legs.
Here, Tom, try a sautéed tarantula.
Arrival on Strut 14, blared the loudspeaker overhead. London airship GE-47, carrying passengers only.
Tom jumped up, and his chair fell backward with a crash. He could remember the little fast-moving scout ships that the engineers used to survey London's tracks and superstructure, and he remembered how they didn't have names, just registration codes, and how all the codes started with GE.
"They've sent someone after us," he gasped.
Miss Fang was rising to her feet as well.
"It might just be coincidence," she said. "There must be lots of airships from London, and even if Valentine has sent someone after you, you are among friends. We are more than a match for your horrible beef burgers."
"Beef eaters,"
Tom corrected her automatically, although he knew that she had made the mistake deliberately, just to break the tension. He saw Hester smile and felt glad that she was there, and fiercely determined to protect her. Then all the lights went out. There were shouts, boos, a crash of falling crockery from the kitchens. The windows were dim, twilight-coloured shapes cut out of the dark.
"The electrics are off all over Airhaven," said Lindstrom's gloomy voice. "The power plant must have failed."
"No," said Hester quickly. "I know this trick. It's meant to create chaos and stop us leaving. Someone's here, coming for us."
There was an edge of panic in her voice that Tom hadn't heard before, not even in the chase at Staines. Suddenly, he felt very frightened. From the far end of the room, where crowds of people were spilling out onto the moonlit high street, a sudden scream arose. Then came another, and a long crash of breaking glass, shrieks, curses, the clatter of chairs and tables falling. Two green lamps bobbed above the crowd, like corpse lanterns.
"That's no beef-eater," said Hester.
Tom couldn't tell if she was frightened or relieved.
"Hester Shaw!"
screeched a voice, like a saw cutting metal. Over by the doorway a sudden cloud of vapour bloomed, and out of it stepped a stalker. It was 7 feet tall, and beneath its coat shone metal armour. The flesh of its long face was pale, glistening with a slug-like film of mucus, and here and there a blue-white jag of bone showed through the skin. Its mouth was a slot full of metal teeth. Its nose and the top of its head were covered by a long metal skull piece with tubes and flexes trailing down like dreadlocks, their ends plugged into ports on its chest. Its round glass eyes gave it a startled look, as if it had never gotten over the horrible surprise of what had happened to it. Because that was the worst thing about the stalkers. They had been human once, and somewhere beneath that iron cowl a human brain was trapped.
"It's impossible," Tom whimpered. "There aren't any stalkers. They were all destroyed centuries ago."
But the stalker stood there still, horribly real. Tom tried to back away, but he couldn't move. Something was trickling down his legs, as hot as spilled tea, and he realized that he had wet himself. The stalker came forward slowly, shoving aside the empty chairs and tables. Fallen glasses burst under its feet. From the shadows behind, an aviator swung at it with a sword, But the blade rebounded from its armour, and it smashed the man aside with a sweeping blow of one huge fist, not even bothering to glance back.
"Hester Shaw," it said. "Thomas Natsworthy."
"It knows my name," he thought.
"I..."
began Miss Fang, but even she seemed lost for words. She pulled Tom backward, while Cora and the others drew their swords and stepped between the creature and its prey. But Hester pushed past them.
"It's all right," she said, in a strange, thin voice. "I know him. Let me talk to him."
The stalker swung its dead-white face from Tom to Hester, lenses whirring inside mechanical eyes.
"Hester Shaw,"
it said, caressing her name with its gas-leak hiss of a voice.
"Hello, Shrike," said Hester.
The great head tilted to stare down at her. A metal hand rose, hesitated, then touched her face, leaving streaks of oil.
"I'm sorry I never got the chance to say goodbye."
"I work for the Lord Mayor of London now," said Shrike. "He has sent me to kill you."
Tom whimpered again. Hester gave a brittle little laugh.
"But you won't do it, will you, Shrike? You wouldn't kill me."
"Yes,"
said Shrike flatly, still staring down at her.
"No, Shrike," whispered Hester,
and Miss Fang seized her chance. She drew a little fan-shaped sliver of metal from a pocket in the sleeve of her coat and sent it whirling toward the stalker's throat. It made an eerie moaning sound as it flew, unfolding into a shimmering, razor-edged disc.
"A Nuevo Mayan battle frisbee,"
gasped Tom, who had seen such weapons safe in glass cases in the weapons and warfare section at the museum. He knew that they could sever a man's neck at 60 paces, and he tensed, waiting for the stalker's skull to drop from its shoulders. But the frisbee just hit Shrike's armored throat with a clang and lodged there, quivering. The slit of a mouth lengthened into a long smile, and the stalker darted forward quick as a lizard. Miss Fang sidestepped, jumped past it, and swung a high kick, but it was far too fast for her.
"Run!"
she shouted at Hester and Tom.
"Get back to the Jenny! I'll follow!"
What else could they do? They ran. The thing snatched at them as they ducked past, but Cora was there to grab its arm, and Niels Lindstrom swung his sword at its face. The stalker flung Cora off and raised its hand. There were sparks and a shriek of metal on metal, and Lindstrom dropped the broken sword and howled and clutched his arm. It threw him aside and lifted Anna off her feet as she came at it again, swinging her hard against Cora and Yasmina when they rushed to her aid.
"Miss Fang!"
shouted Tom. For a moment he thought of going back, but he knew enough about stalkers to know that there was nothing he could do. He ran after Hester, over a heap of bodies in the doorway, and out into shadows and twilight and the frightened milling crowds. A siren was keening mournfully. There was acrid smoke on the breeze, and over by the power plant he thought he saw the flicker of the thing all aviators feared the most, fire.
"I don't understand,"
gasped Hester, talking to herself, not Tom.
"He wouldn't kill me. He wouldn't."
But she kept running, and together they dashed out onto Strut 7, where the Jenny Hanover was waiting for them. But Shrike had already made certain that the little airship would not be going anywhere that night. The envelope had been slashed, the cowling of the starboard engine pod had been wrenched open like an old tin can, and a spaghetti of torn wiring spilled out onto the quay. Among it lay the broken body of the boy Miss Fang had paid to guard her ship. Tom stood staring at the wreckage. Behind him, faintly, growing closer, footsteps trod the metal deck. Pung, 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 pung. He looked around for Hester. and found her gone. Limping away along the docking ring, running downhill, he realized, for the damaged air town was developing a worrying tilt. He shouted her name and sprinted after her, following her out onto a neighboring strut. A tattered-looking balloon had just arrived there, spilling out a family of startled sightseers who weren't sure if the darkness and the shouting meant an emergency or some sort of carnival. Hester shouldered her way through them and grabbed the balloonist by his goggles, heaving him out of his basket. It sagged away from the quay as she leaped in.
"Stop! Thieves! Hijackers! Help!"
the balloonist was shouting, but all Tom could hear was that faint, appalling pung, 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 approaching fast along the high street.
"Tom, come on!"
He summoned all his courage and leaped after Hester. She was fumbling at the mooring ropes as he landed in the bottom of the basket.
"Throw everything overboard," she shouted at him.
He did as he was told, and the balloon lurched upward, level with the first floor windows, with the rooftops, with the spire of St. Michael's. Soon, Airhaven was a donut of darkness, falling away behind them and below. And Shrike was just a speck, his green eyes glowing as he stalked out along the strut to watch them go. Chapter 13. The Resurrected Man. In the Dark Ages, before the dawn of the Traction Era, nomad empires had battled one another across the volcano maze of Europe. It was they who had built the Stalkers, dragging dead warriors off the battlefields and bringing them back to a sort of life by wiring weird old-tech machines into their nervous systems. The empires were long forgotten, but the terrible resurrected men were not. Tom could remember playing at being one when he was a child in the guild orphanage, stomping about with his arms held out straight in front of him, shouting, "I am a stalker, exterminate," until Miss Plym came and told him to keep the noise down. But he had never expected to meet one. As the stolen balloon scudded eastward on the night wind, he sat shuddering in the swaying basket, twisted sideways so that Hester wouldn't see the wet stain on his breeches, and said, "I thought they all died hundreds of years ago. I thought they were all destroyed in battles or went mad and tore themselves apart."
"Not Shrike," said Hester.
"And he knew you."
"Of course he did," she said. "We're old friends, Shrike and me."
She had met him the morning after her parents died, the morning when she woke up on the shores of the hunting ground in the whispering rain. She had no idea how she came to be there, and the pain in her head was so bad that she could barely move or think. Drawn up nearby was the smallest, filthiest town that she had ever seen. People with big wicker baskets on their backs were coming down out of it on ladders and gangplanks, and sifting through the flotsam on the tide line before returning with their baskets full of scrap and driftwood. A few were carrying her father's rowboat away, and it wasn't long before some of them discovered Hester. Two men came and looked down at her. One was a typical scavenger, small and filthy, with bits of an old bug piled in his basket. After he had peered at her for a while, he stepped back and said to his companion,
"Sorry, Mr. Shrike, I thought she might be one for your collection, but she's flesh and blood, all right."
He turned and stumped away across the steaming garbage, losing all interest in Hester. He only wanted stuff he could sell, and there was no value in a half-dead child. Old bug tires now, those were worth something. The other man stayed where he was, looking down at Hester. It was only when he reached down and touched her face, and she felt the cold, hard iron beneath his gloves, that she realized he was not really a man at all. When he spoke, his voice sounded like a wire brush being scraped across a blackboard.
"You can't stay here, child," he said,
and picked her up and slung her over his shoulder and took her aboard the town. It was called Stroll, and it was home to 50 tough, dust-hardened scavengers who robbed Old-Tech sites when they could find them and scrounged salvage from the leavings of larger towns when they could not. Shrike lived with them, but he was no scavenger. When criminals from one of the great traction cities escaped into the out-country, Shrike would track them and cut off their heads, which he carefully preserved. When he crossed that city's path again, he would take the head to the authorities and collect his reward. Why he bothered to rescue her, Hester never did discover. It could not have been out of pity, for he had none. The only sign of tenderness she ever saw in him was when he busied himself with his collection. He was fascinated by old automata and mechanical toys, and he would buy any that passing scavengers brought to him. His ramshackle quarters in Stroll were full of them. Animals, knights in armor, clockwork soldiers with keys in their backs, even a life-size angel of death pulled from some elaborate clock. But his favorites were all women or children, beautiful ladies in moth-eaten gowns, and pretty girls and boys with porcelain faces. All night long, Shrike would patiently dismantle and repair them, exploring the intricate escapements of their hearts, as if searching for some clue to the workings of his own. Sometimes it seemed to Hester that she, too, was part of his collection. Did she remind him of the wounds that he had suffered on the battlefields of forgotten wars when he had still been human? She shared his home for 5 long years, while her face healed badly into a permanent ruined scowl, and her memories came slowly back to her. Some were startlingly clear, the waves on the shores of Oak Island, her mum's voice, the moor wind, with its smells of wet grass and the dung of animals. Others were murky and hard to understand. They flashed into her mind just as she was falling asleep, or caught her unawares while she wandered amongst the silent mechanical figures in Shrike's house. Blood on the star charts, a metallic noise, a man's long, handsome face with sea-grey eyes. They were broken shards of memory, and they had to be carefully collected and pieced together, just like the bits of machinery the scavengers dug up. It was not until she overheard some men telling stories about the great Thaddeus Valentine that she started to make sense of it all. She found that she recognized that name. It was the name of the man who had killed her mum and dad and turned her into a monster. She knew what she had to do without even having to think about it. She went to Shrike and told him she wanted to go after Valentine.
"You must not,"
was all the stalker said.
"You'll be killed."
"Then come with me,"
she had pleaded, but he would not. He had heard about London and about Magnus Chrome's love of technology. He thought that if he went there, the Guild of Engineers would overpower him and cut him into pieces to study in their secret laboratories.
"You must not go,"
was all that he would say. So she went anyway, waiting till he was busy with his automata, then slipping out of a window and out of Stroll, and setting off across the wintry out-country with a stolen knife in her belt in search of London and revenge.
"I've never seen him since that,"
she told Tom, shivering in the basket of the stolen balloon. "Stroll was down on the shores of the English Sea when I left, but here Shrike is, working for Magnus Chrome and wanting to kill me. It doesn't make sense."
"Maybe you hurt his feelings when he ran away,"
suggested Tom.
"Shrike doesn't have feelings," said Hester. "They cleaned all his memories and feelings away when they made a stalker of him."
"She sounds as if she envies him," thought Tom. But at least the sound of her voice had helped to calm him, and he had stopped shaking. He sat and listened to the wind sigh through the balloon's rigging. There was a black stain on the western clouds that he thought must be the smoke from Airhaven. Had the aviators managed to get the fires under control, or had their town been destroyed? And what about Anna Fang? He realized that Shrike had probably murdered her, along with all her friends. That kind, laughing aviatrix was dead, as dead as his own parents. It was as if there was a curse on him that destroyed everybody who was kind to him. If only he had never met Valentine, if only he had stayed safely in the museum where he belonged.
"She might be all right," said Hester suddenly, as if she had guessed what he was thinking about. "I think Shrike was just playing with her. He didn't have..."